Accession number 8736, rule number 45.
Harding, tape 45. Could I ask you, Lord Harding, you were talking about the problems regarding the schools and school children. What measures you adopted? Did, for instance, you ever have to close the schools or any of them?
My memory is a bit uncertain about what exactly was done in that respect, but I think some schools did have to be closed. They were the source of agitation. And a propaganda, of course, and pro-Greek propaganda, which was, it was a nuisance. It had nuisance value because the children were being indoctrinated with political views and opinions about the about Innocence. And how essential it was to work for it, and how everybody must subscribe to support of IOCA and so on and so forth. Now, I think some schools were closed. We did go into the whole thing thoroughly, and some schoolmasters, I think, were suspended. But I don't remember the details, I'm afraid.
This would have been mainly the Greek schools.
Oh, yes, the Greek schools. Yes, essentially. Yes, it was solely the Greek schools.
Did you have to withdraw money at all from the schools? Can you remember if that
was ever done? I can't. Honestly, I can't remember, I'm afraid. I dare say some grants were, some schools were closed, some grants were stopped, some teachers were suspended. But beyond those general remarks, I really can't remember details.
Were there any obvious flagrancies, such as the flying of Greek flags?
Well, they flew Greek flags on their schools, and of course they staged demonstrations and so on. And I think we stopped the flying of Greek flags. Well, I'm sure we did that by regulation and by orders from... but most of all the details, of course, were dealt with by the government officials who were responsible for education.
You have described very well the IOCA activities that you had to contend with. Could I now ask you in more detail the measures you had to take to deal with activities such as, you know, the terrorism, the sabotage, intimidation, etc.?
Well, of course, the most important, the two most important measures that were taken was to get the police back into an effective organization. And on the recommendations of the police commission that I asked to be sent out, which was one chief constable, two chief constables, and one Her Majesty's inspectors of police, and they came out, including Geoffrey White, who I knew very well before. They came out and went very thoroughly into the state and the organization of the police, and they made a number of recommendations, including the change in the chief of police and the recruitment of British personnel, both for the ordinary police and for special branch and for the CID. And the Home Office agreed to that proposal that they should recruit in this country a police force raised from the various British constabularies, county constabularies. And that was built up, and it came to about 500 all told, in what we call the UK Cyprus Police Unit, that it included expert personnel for the special branch and for the CID, and also senior police officers to take charge of the various police districts And that took time, of course, but it was very effective. And they were instrumental in resuscitating the police force, and gradually it was put back on the map with their help and support. They were the nucleus, so to speak, of a reformed Cyprus police force, which did still contain some Greeks, and we tried to recruit both Greeks and Turks into it. And then later on, we formed a Turkish mobile group, which has been heavily criticized in some quarters, but was a very necessary way of building up the peace to an effective strength. And they were a mobile reserve police force available to deal with the emergencies and to be moved to any part of the island. That was the police. Well, then, as far as the army was concerned, I explained that it was necessary to spread a network of patrols and listening posts over the whole island, and that called for more troops. So I had to ask for substantial, really substantial reinforcements. And I can't remember the figures now, but it built the total force up to a considerable size, and that called for a rearrangement of command, and so as to provide a brigade headquarters for each of the main districts. Then there was the training of the troops, and particularly in working in the forest and in marksmanship, and the development of tactics to hunt down the mountain gangs and to locate them and hunt them down and defeat them, and also the support of the police in the urban areas. And all that required calls for training, equipment, and so on. And those are the things mainly. I think it's still classified, but there is an brochure on the lessons of the emergency, dealing with all these matters in detail. And I think it's still a classified document. It was produced by George Baker, and contains all the problems on the army side that arose, and how they were dealt with and resolved. And I can't speak from memory about exactly all that was done, but the main things were the rebuilding of an effective police force by the raising in the UK, and the fitting into Cyprus of a UK police unit covering all police expertise. A contingent of about 500 strong, including dogs and women police eventually, as a training of the reinforcement of the army, and the training of the troops in how competing with operations in the forests and mountains in the forest of jungle and in marksmanship.
You were saying about this Turkish police force, you know, the number of Turks involved. Did that form a provocation towards the Greeks, do you think? You were saying that you were criticised.
Yes, I don't know that the Greeks... I suppose the Greeks complained about it. I think they said the Turks, you see, were partisan. I think there was no justification for it. But it was a simple item of criticism for those people who set out to criticize the way in which we were conducting the emergency.
You mentioned some of the events towards the end of 1955. Am I right in thinking you thought it necessary to have a state of emergency in Cyprus at that time?
Yes. we were finding it extremely difficult to get evidence. I mean, there were strong, very strong circumstantial suspicion about various individuals being involved in EOCA and being concerned with their supply, communications, and so on. And it was under emergency conditions, it is extremely difficult to get evidence, and very often the only way of getting evidence is to disclose the sources of intelligence and information. So the one necessary thing to have in those circumstances is the right to arrest and detain people without trial. And that was, the need for that was one of the main reasons for declaring a state of emergency. Also, the declaration of a state of emergency gives the governor and the government power to impose various other regulations which are not normal under the law. But arrest and detention without trial is the principal one.
So this would have put events on a different footing, I imagine, once you had declared a state of emergency. Am I right in thinking that?
Well, it was a facility, so to speak, for the security forces and for government. Yes, it gave powers to the government which were not normally there and were not normally necessary. It had been applied in other places. It was applied in Malaya, it was applied in Kenya. And there has been states of emergency declared even in the UK.
Is it a very big decision to make to recommend a state of emergency?
Well, it's an important decision to make. Yes, it's a very important, and it's one that calls for very careful consideration before doing it. I mean, under the emergency regulations, eventually, I made it, introduce a regulation which made it mandatory on the courts to impose the death penalty, not on people convicted of murder, but on people who were convicted of being in possession of arms, ammunition, and explosives. And looking back on it, I think that was one of the most effective things that was done in preventing preventing people from joining forces with the EOCA and limiting their support, particularly on the supply side, the supply of arms, ammunition, and explosives. Well, there were all sorts of things. Then you see there were explosives. Were in use, in general use, in the various mines, the copper mines, the asbestos mines in Cyprus, and that was a source of supply for the for EOCA, and that had to be put under control. And that again is something you can't do through the ordinary processes of the law. But there was a lot of argument about the introduction of martial law. Well, martial law is a different matter from the declaration. The imposition of martial law is a different thing from the declaring a state of emergency. You can declare a state of emergency and still the civil courts of law can continue to function. And you only resort to martial law, which means setting up military courts in place of the civil courts of justice, this is my view, when the civil courts, because of the terrorism and the state of to which the emergency is extended, prevent the civil courts from functioning at all. But there is a big distinction between declaring a state of emergency and the imposition of martial law. I resisted any suggestions to impose martial law for various reasons, but the political reason of having to close the civil courts of justice, and also the problem of replacing them with military tribunals. And that was neither necessary nor desirable.
You never ever felt that might
no,
happen?
No, I never seriously considered it. In fact, I definitely opposed any suggestions that were made by officials or by outsiders or by observers or anybody.
The death penalty, which you extended to the carrying of arms, did you ever have to carry that out? You know, were there many cases of people being caught carrying arms?
I don't remember the details. Actually, I think I'm right in saying that there were 8 death penalties imposed by the on conviction by the civil court. The ordinary processes of the civil law and the criminal law that were not commuted, and that brings into question the exercise of the of what's called the royal prerogative, which is the power to confirm or to commute a death sentence. And the instructions or the guidelines or whatever you like to call them for the exercise of the royal prerogative are perfectly clear. I think I've referred to them already. They are that the individual who is empowered to exercise the royal prerogative has to give full consideration to all relevant factors of a public and a private nature. So, and those are things you have to weigh and consider extremely carefully before you either confirm or commute a death sentence.
Did you find that a very taxing task, having to do that?
Well, it's a very anxious thing to do. I mean, obviously, you don't want to unjustly or unreasonably have a man deprived of his life and put an end to his life. So it's something you weigh the factors very, very carefully. You must do. It's, otherwise you're being irresponsible. I found that, it is exacting, and it's anxious too. You are anxious, very anxious, to make sure, first of all, that the judge who convicted the criminal and imposed the death penalty on him, all the evidence was satisfactory and convincing and clear, and then that there were no private or public factors, relevant factors, that should be weighed against carrying out the sentence. Yes, it is. It's a taxing and an anxious task, and not one that you can undertake lightly.
It would appear from what you said that you did commute quite a few death sentences.
I can't remember.
To life.
Yes. I certainly told you the case of Nicholas Sampson. Well, I think I was wrong in commuting the sentence.
I've read that there were placards up calling you Hangman Harding.
Well, dare say.
Yeah, how did you react to that? How did you react to that?
Well, you can't. I mean, if you take notice of those things, of your raking, so to speak, in the minds and the eyes of the public, you're failing in your duty.
Once the death sentence had been imposed, what was the method of execution?
Hanging.
Who would have done that?
The prison service is done within the prison premises, and I don't know who pointed to that. The prison service existed in Cyprus like it did in any other crown colony or in this country. The prison service. And as long as the death penalty was not entirely removed, there would be provision in the death sentence for the mechanics and machinery of carrying out a hanging.
Were you presented with many appeals? You know, or was the legal
situation? Yes, of course. I remember certainly in more than one case, the counsel for the defence coming and putting a case for commutation to me personally.
And that would have been weighed up with the
You have to weigh the whole thing up. You have to listen to, you must listen to what they say. You must consider very carefully the weight of their argument, of their appeal for commutation or for dismissal of the trial. And these are things that you have to consider to the best of your ability and then decide. And if these are difficult decisions to make. But you have to do them. It's your duty and responsibility.
Did you have any ruling on the funerals of AOCA personnel? You know, for instance, did they make public display of these?
Yes,
like they
did. I can't remember the detail of what we did. Yes, I mean, when you've got the same sort of thing that is going on regularly now in Ulster. An attempt to gain publicity and support by staging a funeral of a man, an AOCA personnel or an AOCA individual who had been shot and or killed in the course of the operations. And it's always a problem to what extent you intervene and interfere with these things. Generally speaking, I didn't have the problem that they have in Ulster of, so to speak, an armed guard firing a salute at a funeral. I don't remember any incident of that kind. But of course, a funeral was made the occasion of a widespread demonstration. And I used to be asked questions, saying when I went to visit, if I visited a village, if I talked to the people in the coffee shop, the representatives, I sometimes got asked, why did I confirm the sentence on so-and-so and so-and-so? And I gave my reasons for doing so.
If, say, a British soldier was killed, what sort of funeral would he have?
Well, he'd have an ordinary military funeral and a proper military funeral in the military cemetery, attended by with an escort from his regiment, and attended by representatives of his regiment and of the probably of the other regiments serving in that same area.
Could I ask you now about punishments, Lord Harding? Was there any corporal punishment for offenders?
Well, at one time, we reintroduced a flogging. Particularly for juveniles, and it was thought that this would be a curb on rioting and demonstrations by school children and juveniles. But there is no tradition of corporal punishment in the Greek history. And it didn't serve the purpose of being a deterrent, so we abandoned it. But it was reintroduced, and also, of course, we introduced curfews. Again, when it was necessary from the point of view of giving the police every opportunity both to get control and to prevent movement of the AOCA, and and their supply and support. It's it's something that you have to consider very carefully before you impose a curfew. You do impose great hardship on the whole community of the town or village involved. And I think there was one case, for example, where I think it was Lefconico, where the local regiment had a football match, and then at the end of the match they were changing and drinking, refreshing themselves by the football ground, and a bomb was thrown at them, and several of them were killed. And there was tremendous resentment and feeling about this. And that's the case where a curfew was imposed on that village and a collective fine. But all these things, like curfews, collective fines, flogging, and other things, are of questionable value. And you have to be very, very certain that it is going to, that what you do is going to be entertainment. And very often, sometimes it isn't.
I suppose
it's a difficult decision to make about imposing any sort of restrictions on the life of the community.
I suppose with a country like Cyprus, particularly in the hot season, it could have been very irksome. It would have been a severe punishment.
Yeah. And well, it is.
And did it interfere with the economic life? You know, for instance, the bars, the hotels.
Well, it must have done, yes. It must have done, yes. To what extent, I don't know.
But this would have been a calculated risk for you, would it not?
Well, it has to be. It's one of the factors that you had to weigh up when you do it. I mean, the hardships that you impose on the community as a whole is against the advantages you gain from a security point of view. And it's a very nice balance. And a difficult one which to decide.
Did you have privilege passes for curfews? You know, were certain individuals still allowed about?
I don't know. I dare say. These sort of things, these are details were left, of course, to the local security committees.